I have never had the privilege of introducing a governor before, although I have spoken before four different presidents. It was a dinner out at Mount Rushmore once a few years ago, and I didn't gauge their reaction. They were rather stone-faced, maybe. But before I introduce the governor, I have a couple other people that I would like to introduce. And first of all, Keith and Michelle Banwart in the back. Would you mind standing, Keith and Michelle? I've known Keith since third grade at Whittier Elementary School in Sioux City. And Michelle, she lived a few blocks from me the other direction, got to know her in junior high. And anyway, we were always friends back in those days. And as we got into high school, we started to realize that we shared some of the same conservative beliefs as well, theologically, politically, and in other ways. And Keith recently retired as the principal of school, and Michelle are now living in Altoona. And anyway, they are part of, is it Hope Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Church there in Altoona? Then I'd like to introduce somebody else too, and this is Julian Garrett. Julian and Nancy, well, I should say that when I came to the University of Iowa for law school in 67, Julian had just graduated. He was an assistant attorney general and a conservative political activist and was a mentor in many ways to Governor Branstad and me both. He served as an attendant at our wedding in 1970, and over the years he's been a conservative Republican activist and a lawyer and a farmer just south of Des Moines. In 2010, he was elected to the state legislature, reelected, and now he is in a special race about a week and a half from now for a vacant state senate seat, the district that includes Indianola and some of that surrounding area. And it's great to see Julian and Nancy once again. And so they're here as my guests, but the one I'm introducing as a speaker today is Governor Branstad. And back in 1967, some 46 years ago, when I came to the law school at the University of Iowa, Governor Branstad, well, he wasn't governor yet, but at any rate, you could tell that he was heading in that direction, but he was a conservative political activist, and so we immediately became close friends and allies as we worked for common causes together. And those were the days of the Students for a Democratic Society, the revolutionaries on campus and the like, and we led the opposition to them in various ways, articles in the school paper and demonstrations of our own and other things that I don't think I will mention because I'm not sure what the statute of limitations is. But at any rate, Terry has gone on from there, and I'm going to tell you something that I don't think Terry knows, although his memory is fantastic. But as we were involved in the College Republican activities together in those days, and those were the days when it was the Reagan and Goldwater people versus the Rockefeller people. We hadn't invented the term rhino yet, but we would have used it if we'd heard it, I'm sure. But we were absolutely convinced that our battles in the College Republicans of Iowa, that the freedom of the state of Iowa and probably of the United States and maybe of the world and beyond depended on us. And so we devoted a lot of hours in that kind of activity. One time we were up in my hometown, Sioux City, and Terry stayed at our house with us. And this is what I don't think Terry knew, is that after he was elected governor, for decades after that, my dad had a sign on that bedroom saying, Governor Branstad slept here. And that sign was there until about 1994 when they sold the house and moved into a retirement home. So you are famous. You have historical markers for you, Governor Branstad. We've been in contact periodically since that time. We considered going into law practice in Lake Mills together back around 1980. It seems like the Lord led each of us in some different directions at that time. Terry with the Army, me with the Air Force, and Terry into government, and me into teaching. But he has been the longest-serving governor in Iowa history, and that's before he was brought back. after he left and served as president of a medical college, as the other party was running the governorship and the state was kind of unraveling financially, they called him back and he was elected to another term and is serving again as governor, and I have no idea what his plans are after this. But besides being the longest-serving governor in Iowa history, he also has another distinction that I think is very important to us, and that is that he has been a firm friend of the unborn child and a firm friend of the pro-life movement and traditional values in general. So with that, I'd like to call Governor Branstad up to speak to us, and I would like to share one thing with him first. This is my latest three-volume book set, and I'd like you to have these.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, you can set them down there if you wish.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, that's quite an introduction. John Eidsmo, thank you very much. As John mentioned, we've been longtime friends, and he succeeded me as the chair of the College Republicans at the University of Iowa, and also when we were trying to legalize homeschooling in Iowa, John came and testified before the legislature, and I want to update you a little bit. We made some more progress this year. This year in our education reforms, we not only made some improvements for public education, we also have something called the Student Tuition Organization that provides financial assistance, provides a tax credit for people that contribute to students with financial need to go to Christian schools and non-public schools, and we increased that substantially. We also provided for independent accreditation for non-public schools in the state of Iowa. And for homeschoolers, we relaxed some of the stringent regulations to give more flexibility and more freedom to parents, and also to be able to teach driver's education to their own children. So we made some significant progress, and John was one of the experts we brought in back in, what year would have been, about 1990, John? Yeah, late 1980s, Iowa was one of the last states to legalize homeschooling. And we all know that that's been very successful, and today we have tens of thousands of kids, I think maybe 20 or 30,000 kids that are homeschooled in the state of Iowa, and we have many children also go to Lutheran and Catholic and other Christian schools in our state. And John has been a very knowledgeable and has written extensively on these issues, so it's kind of fun to be here. Julian Garrett brought me to my first Republican meeting. I grew up in a Democrat family, but I read Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative in high school, so I determined that I was a conservative. And I actually, my first year at the University of Iowa in 1965, I joined the Young Democrats, but as John mentioned, this was the era of the SDS and people that wanted to overthrow the establishment and throw out our free enterprise system and go to a socialist system. And I hope to someday become part of the establishment. So obviously I didn't feel much at home with that group. And then Julian Garrett invited me to go to a College Republican meeting, and the speaker was a young state representative named Chuck Grassley, and who's now our senior senator from Iowa. And so Julian and John and I were all part of that conservative movement way back then at the University of Iowa, which is obviously a very liberal campus in our state. It's great to speak to you, and I want to encourage people to continue to eat. I'm used to speaking to the Iowa legislature, so it doesn't bother me at all. I also want to give greetings from Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds. She would like to have been here today, but she had a previous commitment, and you all know that she and I were elected as a team. We're both a very strong pro-life conservatives, and she's been a great teammate, and I've met my match in terms of energy, enthusiasm, and passion to serve the people of Iowa. So She wanted me to be certain to greet you, and I know that both of us feel very strongly about the need to stand up and support the pro-life movement. We would also like to thank all the pro-life leaders that helped organize this conference. Thank you for what you do on behalf of the pro-life cause and behalf of life at all stages of development, from unborn to the frail elderly. As governor of Iowa, one of my first priorities is to protect the health, safety, and well-being of all of our citizens, and this includes the unborn. In 1996, I had the opportunity to sign a parental notification law, and I also, in my previous time, signed a conscience clause legislation. And more recently, I've been able to appoint pro-life people like Monsignor Frank Bignano to the State Board of Medicine. I believe it's important that we do all we can to try to set a tone of support and encouragement for people that want to protect human life. And I want to do all I can to encourage you, and I know there are many pastors here, to share the message of how important and precious human life is. We need to make sure that we're doing all we can to educate people about the importance of life. And I think we are making progress. I see many more young people today that understand and appreciate and respect life and how important it is. I happen to have three grown children. My youngest child was born on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Marcus was born on January 22nd. He'll be 30 years old this January. And he and his wife are expecting their first child next month. December 5th is the due date, in fact. So we're very excited about it. We have five granddaughters. And, you know, in this day and age, you can know in advance. So this is going to be a grandson, we're told. So we even had a gender unveiling party at Terrace Hill this summer. So the whole thing was, we had my daughter-in-law, who's the expectant mother, sent out invitations to what we called the baby queue. So we had barbecue dinner, and then afterwards, and we had all the adults at one table and all the little girls at another table. You were supposed to dress in whichever color, you either blue or pink, depending upon what you thought the baby would be. And then when they brought in, and even the mother and father did not know. The doctor gave a slip to the chef, and her husband delivered, and then the ice cream was either going to be blue or pink. And when they came with the blue ice cream, my son, who's an avid hunter, his reaction was unbelievable. And they caught the whole thing on video. His wife's sister videoed the whole thing, and so that was something to behold. And of course, we're all looking forward to that special occasion, the birth of their baby, which is scheduled, as I said, to be next month. So I know how important human life is, and I know how precious it is, and it's so wonderful to be able to interact with the five granddaughters that we have, and we're certainly looking forward to the grandson as well. I think the key in sharing our position, it's important that we do it in a way that shows that we are compassionate people and that we do have strong views and strong feelings about life. But as pro-life citizens and pro-life men and women, it's important that we remain engaged and involved in the public square, and that we do all we can to try to, in a very gentle and but very caring way, show how important life is, and life is to all of us and at all stages. Our focus should be on really helping to educate the broader community, and I think you as pastors and religious leaders, people that are respected in the community, can play an important role in helping us in hopefully encouraging the people that do serve in public office to recognize their responsibility is also to protect the most vulnerable among us. So I just want to say it's an honor to be here. I appreciate this chance to share with me, to share with you my personal convictions and my hope that we can continue to see progress made on this very important issue of human life. Thank you very much. If there are questions, I'd be glad to take questions.
How long do you think it'll take you to read those three volumes?
Well, with all the other reading I've got to do, it may take a little while. But I'm looking forward to it, and it's pretty interesting. Historical and Theological Foundations of Law, Volume 1. And that goes to Ancient Wisdom. And then it's Historical and Theological Foundations of Law, Volume 2, Classical and Medieval. And then it's Historical and Theological Foundations of Law, Volume 3 is Reformation and Colonial. So it's obviously a very historical perspective. I've got a great interest in history, and some of you may know that there's a publication in Iowa called the Iowa History Journal. And that is something that comes out about every 2 months, and it's something I really enjoy. It's just part of Iowa history. But it's not, I don't think, probably near as deep as this is going to be. Are there questions? Yes. Okay, here's what happened. After I became governor again, I appointed a number of pro-lifers to the State Board of Medicine. And that board, which had been dominated by people that were on the other side of the issue, obviously was changed over this period of the last 3 years that I've been governor. And then I appointed a pro-life woman from Dubuque, and the Senate Democrats rejected her just because she was pro-life. So I then, last year, appointed Monsignor Bignano, who is, I'm Catholic, he's my priest. He also was the one that organized Pope John Paul II's visit here in 1979. And I knew they wouldn't dare take him down. So he was confirmed. He was confirmed, and there's a group of doctors, and actually women doctors, that challenged this webcam abortion and brought a petition to the State Board of Medicine asking that it be stopped because it doesn't meet the standard of care that should be provided. Because Iowa law says that you should have a medical examination from a doctor if you're going to have an abortion. Well, this is done at a distance, and it's done over the internet, and there's no examination that occurs whatsoever. And so they said this doesn't meet the standard of care that's required in medicine, and so they, and as you know, that the board then, they took this issue up, and Dr. Halverstrom is the chair of it. He's an emergency room physician who's dealt with some of the ramifications of some of these abortion issues, and the board, I think, voted 8-2 to stop this practice. Now, that was supposed to happen just in the last few days, but Planned Parenthood, of course, the organization that performs the abortions, went to court and asked for an injunction, and they found a judge that granted an injunction. And so now the next step will be, and that just delays the decision on this, but the judge's decision, obviously, now So the next step will be to hear the merits of the case, and then then of course the next step would be if the judge continues to prevent the implementation of the new rule, would be to appeal that. So that's the situation. Other questions? Yes, sir. Well, I may be Commander-in-Chief of the Iowa National Guard, but the Iowa National Guard's responsibility is basically as a state militia. They have a dual role, and that is they can be called up by the President of the United States as part of our national defense. And as you know, in recent years, the National Guard has been used extensively in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. But as governor, I don't have any authority in terms of overruling the Secretary of Defense or what's happened at the federal level, and I certainly don't agree with some of the changes they've made in military policy recently, be it the issue involving homosexuals or this issue involving women in combat. So I have real concern about the direction this country is going under this present administration and the kind of people they put in charge in the various departments and agencies at the federal level. But that, I think, basically has to be addressed at the ballot box in changing the direction of the leadership of the country. And as a governor of a state, and I happen to be one of 10 governors that's part of the what's called the Governor's Council that advises the Pentagon and the National Guard and Homeland Security. So I get a chance a couple times a year to meet with them, but I can tell you it's been a very frustrating experience because we have, the Pentagon bureaucracy is one of the hardest ones to deal with. I guess that's the easiest way I can put it. We have a great leader, I'm the Commander in Chief, but the Adjutant General is General Timothy Orr, and he is my right-hand guy who runs the Iowa National Guard, and we have, I think, as fine a National Guard as any state has in the country, and I've enjoyed very much working with them. But I am very concerned. I'm also very concerned about what's happening with the massive cutbacks in the American military, and we are, as the state of Iowa, actually going to be, and I would encourage you to stay tuned, because next Tuesday I'm going to be making an announcement on the initiative we're going to make try to get people as they're coming out of the service to move to Iowa. So we're going to make a concerted effort to try, because there's a lot of talented, skilled people. And as I go around the state of Iowa and talk to businesses, I hear the need for more skilled workers. And so we're going to have a lot of talented people coming out of the military because of the cutbacks. And we'd like to get more and more of those people who want to come to Iowa. And with some of the policies that are being put in place in the military, I think there's a lot of military people that are going to decide they do want to leave, when we hope that we'll look at Iowa as a good place in which to come. Yes, sir. Well, that's a good question. you're right. We have been able to make significant progress in building relationships. And the relationship with China, I can tell you this story. I'll try to be very brief about it. My first year as governor, we established a sister state with Hebei province of China. Zhang Shuguang from Hebei came here, and we signed the sister state agreement. He invited us to go to China in 1984. My wife and I led a delegation of 50 Iowans, large group, went to China, and it was like going back in time. Most people were riding bicycles. You just saw military vehicles and bicycles on the street. No building more than six stories tall. We rode on an old steam locomotive from Beijing to Shishazhuang. But we got a very friendly, warm welcome. Presented my wife with a big bouquet of flowers. And the next year, a young man named Xi Jinping led an agriculture delegation to Iowa, along with four other young men. They visited, and I greeted them in the governor's office. They met with Secretary of Agriculture Bob Lounsbury. We signed Luca Baroni, who is an Italian, who went to Iowa State, stayed here, and worked for the Iowa Department of Economic Development. He took them all around the state. Sarah Landy was in charge of the sister state, so it's amazing. And we treated them the same way we would any visitor. The Iowa friendliness and hospitality. But so then I came back as governor in 2011, and I went to China, and I got a personal meeting with Xi Jinping, then the vice president of China, now the president of China. And the first thing he said to me is, Governor Brandt said I was in your office on the 29th day of April, 1985, and he talked about how wonderful he was treated in our state, and the friendliness and hospitality, and he got a chance to see the Mississippi River and go out on the river and visit farms and factories and even go to a birthday party. And so I came up with the idea, well, why don't we have a reunion since he's going to be the next president of China and he's going to go to visit Washington, D.C. So we had that reunion, and he came here, and we had a state dinner for him, and then we also... So it's kind of a long story, but the truth is, the matter is, he now, and relationships are really important in China. And so he actually calls me an old friend. And we do have a very personal relationship and one of trust. However, I'm realistic about, can I influence his administration's position on domestic issues in China? And as we all know, China has this one-child policy, and it's a very cruel and a very bad policy. And I don't, maybe over time it will change, but it isn't our role. My role is try to build friendship and to try to increase trade and try to improve opportunities for Iowans. Foreign policy, obviously, is the role of the federal government, and they have a role to play to try to influence. And there's the human rights issues. There's also issues of intellectual property rights, and many businesses are concerned about that in terms of honoring patents and things like that. And there's many other issues that have to be resolved. I do think having the relationship that we have and the friendship we have has already made a big difference for Iowa. You know, the Chinese are buying more soybeans than all the rest of the countries in the world. They're also buying now, the Chinese company is purchasing Smithfield Foods. And I think it's a good thing for Iowa farmers for this reason. They want a safe, reliable, their economy is improved. They have more people in the middle class, and they want a safe, reliable source of pork. So they're going to be importing a lot of pork from the United States, just like they're importing a lot of soybeans. And I think with it, it's going to come significant amount of corn. And guess what? We are the leading soybean-producing state, the leading pork-producing state, the leading corn-producing state. I think that's all very good for the Iowa economy. But influencing their domestic policies will be more difficult. I do think he's a better leader than the Chinese have had for a long time, and I think he's really interested in the well-being of his people, and all of that is encouraging. But trying to get some of these policies that have been in place for a long time changed in that country will not be easy. But over time, it could happen. I mean, I never imagined when I was growing up that Red China would become even though still a communist country, they have embraced the free market system, and in some sense, they're almost more free market than we are. I mean, they don't have the debt we have, and they understand the importance of the free market and how that's made a real difference in their economy. That's a long answer, but it's a complicated issue, the relationship between the two biggest countries, the two superpowers. And China is the biggest population-wise in the world, and their economy is growing to the point where sometime in the next 20 years, if trends continue, they will surpass us in terms of their gross domestic product. Over here. Would I consider an extended exchange program with Jay Nixon? Jay Nixon is the governor of Missouri. And yeah, I figured that. I want to make sure the rest of the audience knows who Jay Nixon is. He is the governor of Missouri, but that's not permitted. We can't do that. Now, I grew up close to the Minnesota border, and I have people ask me that. But I'm going to tell you my Illinois story. You know, we were competing with Illinois for this Orascom fertilizer plant, which they now call the Iowa Fertilizer Plant, in Lee County. And I met with Mr. Suarez, who is the owner of this company. Now, he is a Coptic Christian from Egypt. And he's a graduate of the University of Chicago. He's a billionaire. He's an extremely successful businessman. And so we're competing for this big investment. I mean, it is $1.8 billion is what this fertilizer plant is going to be. And it was going to be either in Iowa or probably in Illinois. They were pushing for Peoria. And I was telling them the difference between Iowa and Illinois is, first of all, they have the most debt per capita, state and local debt of any state, and they have the worst unfunded pension system. So they might promise you everything. But at the end of the day, they can't afford to do it, and they'll pull the rug out from under you. They most recently have raised taxes while we're cutting taxes. Besides that, most of the former governors of Illinois are in prison. I'm back in office. So, the end of the day, he chose Iowa. I got to tell you one other Illinois joke while we're at it. These two guys are standing in chow line in Illinois prison. One says to the other, "You know, the food was a lot better when you were governor." Now, the sad part is the same people that are running Illinois from Cook County, Chicago, are the same people that are running our government in Washington, D.C. And that's what really does concern me. But anyway, it's sometimes good to be able to joke a little bit about it. I'm at the back. Yes. Well, it's like night and day. Ours works, theirs doesn't. And we kind of knew that. I mean, what we're doing is, and we still haven't gotten a waiver, so here's what we did. We said, well, we'd analyzed this whole thing about just expanding Medicaid and having more people covered. The problem is, just because you have more people covered by Medicaid, well, we've been doing that for the last 30 years, and American health's gotten worse and worse and worse. So just having more people covered with Medicaid isn't the answer. We have set a goal in Iowa, as you may know. We want to become the healthiest state in the nation. And it's a public-private partnership, and we're working with Wellmark and Hy-Vee and Doug Reichardt and many others, and we've been working on this for the last couple of years, and we have the Gallup Healthways Health Index, and they're measuring, and we've gone from 19th to 9th in just 2 years. I'd say going from 9th to 1st is going to be tougher. It, you know, as my old football coach used to say, that when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So we have a long way to go. But, so we decided we wanted a different approach towards dealing with this problem of low-income, uninsured people. And so we called it the Healthy Iowa Plan. Senate Democrats wanted to just expand Medicaid, and we had the Healthy Iowa Plan. They passed their plan in the Senate. The House passed our plan. It went to conference committee, and we ended up working out a compromise, but the compromise is more along the lines of ours. It's called the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan. And what it does is it says if you're below 100% of poverty, then you can sign up. We had a previous waiver from Health and Human Services under the Vilsack administration called Iowa Cares. But to get services there, you had to go to either Broadlands here in Des Moines or the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City. But we came up with an idea that we'd like to be able to provide those services all over the state through what we call accountable care organizations. And the reimbursement for these accountable care organizations, the doctors and hospitals, would be based more on outcomes rather than procedures. The way they've always done it under Medicaid, it's under procedures. So the more procedures you have, the more they get reimbursed. Our idea is reimburse people based on healthy outcomes and keeping people out of the hospital instead of having them in the hospital. And so that's our what our plan is. And the benefits are very similar to what state employees' benefits are, which are really pretty good. But we want everybody to have some skin in the game. So we say the people need to pay, this is a really modest amount, $10 a month as a premium. But if you get a health risk assessment, now my previous job at Des Moines University, all of our faculty, staff, and students did health risk assessments, and that tells you, what your risk factors are, and then you work to reduce your risk factors. And it works. And so if you do a health risk assessment, then the state would reimburse the $10, so it wouldn't even cost you that. That's the sticking point that we have with Secretary Sebelius in getting ours approved. Now, I got this passed by both Democrats and Republicans in the legislature as a bipartisan compromise. And so we thought we would have the waiver by October 1. Well, October 1 comes and goes. Well, you know, she's got her hands full, and they've got that thing so messed up. And so I've had two meetings with her. And the last meeting, I just said, what we are asking for is very simple, and it's fair, and I believe that will work. I believe the reason why they haven't approved it is because they don't want it to work, and because other states will copy what we do. Just as when we did welfare reform in the 90s, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan led the way, other states copied, and we help people with child care and with job training, and we help reduce the welfare rolls by about 50%. Well, our goal is to try to make for healthier outcomes for people rather than just more people under Medicaid. I just think that we got a better... Now, what we did, October 1 came and went, and they hadn't approved it, so we just said, go ahead, we're going to start signing people up because we're going to move forward on good faith, assuming eventually they're going to approve it. And so that's what we've been doing. So I think December 15th is the final deadline. But we're hopeful by December 15th she'll wake up and say, yeah, we've got to approve this, and we'll approve it. So if she doesn't, then all those people that get denied the opportunity to get coverage can look to Sebelius and the Obama administration, and they'll know who to blame. By the way, our exchange is working fine. No problems. They're signing up, and our insurance commissioner, I think, has done a good job. But the federal exchange, as you know, is a nightmare, and there's all kinds of problems with it. By the way, If Obamacare doesn't get repealed, we are presently considering the idea of maybe we'd partner with some of our other neighbors like South Dakota and Nebraska and Kansas. They all have Republican governors. They all have similar conservative philosophies. They have insurance commissioners that my insurance commissioner works with. And so I intend to be visiting with those other governors. We had a Siouxland up in your hometown of Sioux City. We had a Siouxland summit with the governors of South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa. And after that meeting, I said, you know, maybe, and if we did it four states together, it would be much cheaper. One of the reasons why we didn't do our own exchange instead of the partnership was because of the cost of it. But we're thinking if we're still going to have to do an exchange, maybe we do four of these Midwestern conservative states together, prove that we can do it a lot better than the federal government. Anyway, that's kind of where it is. Thank you.
I will tell you one element of good news that I just read in USA Today this morning. The headline said that President Obama is sorry that so many people are losing their health care under his plan. Where that's going to go, who knows. But I was really fascinated to hear the governor talk about the exchange programs here, and especially with China and so on. And I'd like to tell you a little bit of that I've been involved in. The last 5 years, I've been going over to South Korea to teach at a law school in South Korea. And again, that's South Korea. So far, Kim Jong-un has shown very little interest in having me teach in North Korea. But I love to go out for walks in the country and in the hill country just south of the university. There's some corn and fields like that. And I saw this Korean farmer in the field there. And anyway, he would wave at me, and I'd wave back. And then one time he said, hello, and I said hello back. And thought maybe he knows a little English. So I said to him, I have corn farm in America. And he said, where in America is your corn farm? And I said, Iowa. And he said, I have ag degree from Iowa State. But anyway, he's known on campus as the corn doctor. And the next day after, I met him this past fall again, the next day after that, he was taking some special corn he had developed over to China. And he does stuff like that all around the world. And I might add, a very strong, committed Christian as well. And there was one thing I wanted to mention about Julian Garrett that I forgot to mention. Julian and Nancy attend a Missouri Synod church Indianola? In Indianola, okay. And so not only are they on our wavelength pro-life, they're on our wavelength spiritually and theologically as well. I'd like to just address very briefly a couple of issues here in the culture war, and we all know that we're involved in a culture war. And in fact, back in the days when Julian and Terry and I were out there doing battle with the Students for a Democratic Society and other issues like that, the spiritual issues were not quite as clear-cut as they are today. In fact, back in those days, the issue of abortion just wasn't even on the horizon, nor was the issue of gay rights. So things have changed, they've become much more intense, and the spiritual aspects are a lot more clear than they were before. But on the one side, I think we are seeing an anti-Christian movement that in the last few years has been getting much, much more bold. Doug Wilson has said that there are two basic tenets of atheism. Tenet number one, there is no God. Tenet number two, I hate him. And it isn't just a matter they don't believe in God, it's a matter they hate the things that God stands for, and they hate those who stand for those things. And so their view would be that God and the Bible have no place in the public arena, that laws have no spiritual sanction whatsoever. There is no such thing as the laws of nature and of nature's God. That maybe there should be freedom of worship, as the president is fond of saying, but it should take place in the church and maybe the home, but not beyond that. In fact, in the Hobby Lobby case before the Supreme Court right now, the administration's position is that Hobby Lobby, by definition, cannot be engaged in free exercise of religion because they are a for-profit corporation. And therefore, that in these various debates, like the abortion debate, God's word is utterly irrelevant to anything dealing with the public arena today. Now, on the other side of the culture war, we have what we call the Christian right. And I think most of us would say that there's a lot in the Christian right that we can identify with. We see, for example, that they do have a thorough biblical worldview. They believe the Bible is the authoritative word of God and that it therefore is to be the final word on issues that face us today. But as Lutherans, we might have a little problem with the tendency there to take even the Mosaic law, the Mosaic covenant, and seek to apply that to the church or to civil governments today. What I'm going to suggest is needed in the culture war today is a good, strong infusion of Lutheran Two Kingdoms theology. And I would suggest to you that that Lutheran Two Kingdoms theology has been misunderstood in the world today and has been misunderstood by many Lutherans. Luther taught that God is the source of all governmental authority, that he has established these two entities, the church and the state, and delegated certain authority to each of them, and that the state has authority over believers and unbelievers, the church has authority over believers but not unbelievers, which means the believer is the link between the two kingdoms. As he said in his letter on secular authority, that these two kingdoms must be sharply distinguished and both be permitted to remain, that neither is sufficient in the world without the other. See, Luther's concept of the two kingdoms was a far, far cry from that of the American Civil Liberties Union's concept today. Luther's concept of the two kingdoms was that they complement each other. If the church is doing its job properly by saving souls and by training people in good character, they produce better citizens, and they make it easier for the state to govern. If the state is doing its job of keeping the streets free from criminals and keeping the shores free from invaders, then they make it easier for the church to do its job. So the two kingdoms have distinct functions, but those functions should not be at odds with one another. They should complement each other. And Luther emphasized the difference between reason and revelation, but I don't believe he made nearly as sharp a distinction between them as some try to make them today. Certainly he understood that we use reason as we interpret the Bible. But I think Luther would say, as we look to the issues that face us today, issues like abortion, we would formulate our convictions based upon revelation, based upon what the Word of God tells us. For example, as we look to the abortion issue, key question would be, is this unborn child a living human being? Is this unborn child a person? And we look to the scriptures, and I could give you a whole hour on this. I do at various times, and it's in some of the books that are in the book table that I promised Jim I wouldn't mention. But that you look to John the Baptist, and when John the Baptist's mother Elizabeth comes into the presence of Mary, who is carrying Jesus in her womb, she says, not the glob of tissue in my womb, not the fertilized egg in my womb, but the babe in my womb leaped for joy. That sounds to me like a person. Or Jacob and Esau, as we read that they strove together in their mother's womb. But one of the strongest verses, I think, is in Psalm 51, where David says, behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. As I understand that, David is saying that he's had a sinful nature from conception. A sinful nature, I think, has to imply personhood. But when we go out into the civic arena, we need to be prepared to defend our convictions on the basis of reason and evidence. If you go to a political caucus, if you testify before a hospital board or a governmental body, you will present the evidence that demonstrates that the unborn child has a unique DNA all the way from the moment of conception. You demonstrate that the child has a heartbeat probably as early as the 18th day, but that can be detected certainly by the end of the fourth week, and on to the other evidence that you're all familiar with that would convince even a hardened person who has no interest in the Word of God that that unborn child is a person. And when we are involved in the church, my suggestion to us is that the church is not supposed to be primarily a political institution, but that God's Word touches on these issues. And if we're not going to touch on those issues in our preaching, we are not preaching the whole counsel of God. I would suggest that the function of pastors in particular is to teach biblical principles in this area and then leave it to individuals within the church to go out into the community and articulate those principles. Now, I wouldn't say this necessarily means that a pastor should never hold public office, just that when he does, he needs to recognize he's wearing two hats and he needs to keep them distinct. Now, how far we go in that direction is open to some question, some dispute. For example, I think we would all agree it's fine for us to teach from the Bible that personhood begins at conception. Could we go a step further and say, therefore, abortion is the killing of a person, an innocent person, and therefore abortion is wrong? Could we go a step further beyond that and say, because it is wrong, it should also be illegal? Could we go beyond that and say that House Bill 113 would restrict abortion? Can we go beyond that and say, therefore, you should support House Bill 113? Could we go beyond that and say that Senator Jones is in favor of abortion or opposes 114, and Senator Amundsen, I've got to give a good Lutheran name to him, Senator Amundsen is in favor of it? And can I go a step beyond that and say, therefore, you should vote for Senator Amundsen? Well, of course, we come into the issues of the Internal Revenue Service and the prohibitions that are placed on 501c3 organizations. I consider these prohibitions to be a First Amendment violation, and the Alliance Defending Freedom is looking for a case that they can challenge this on. In fact, every fall they have Pulpit Freedom Sunday, where pastors are encouraged to preach a sermon that would technically violate the rules of 501c3, submit a copy of that sermon to the IRS and to the Alliance Defending Freedom, and in the event this is ever challenged by the IRS, the ADF will come and conduct your defense for you. That's what they've been doing, and every year, the number of pastors submitting those sermons to the IRS has increased. Starting with about 70, now it's somewhere around 200 each year. You know how many of these have been investigated by the IRS so far? Zero. Now, I might add, too, some will say, well, I'm advocating disobeying the law. I think there is a place for disobedience, but this isn't disobedience. You are simply engaging, and I'm picking my words carefully, you are engaging in activity that could bring your 501c3 status into question. You are not committing a crime. You are not violating any law by doing that. Anyway, contact the Alliance Defending Freedom or our own Foundation for Moral Law if you have an interest in doing that. Note that the prohibitions of the IRS say that you cannot devote a substantial portion of your activity to influencing legislation. It doesn't say you can't do it at all. It says you can't devote any portion of your church's activity toward influencing the outcome of elections. Doesn't say that you as an individual can't do so, even that you as a pastor can't do so. Whether you can do so from the pulpit, that's an issue that's yet to be resolved. I personally think you can. Anyway, I have a whole seminar I give on that. We'll save that for another convention sometime. Suffice it to say once again that we are in a culture war, and that in this culture war, what is needed, I think, so desperately right now is an infusion of Lutheran blood, an infusion of Lutheran spirit, and an infusion of Lutheran two kingdoms theology. Not only does the Christian right need that, but the Lutheran Church could use a little of that too. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Lamb.
Thank you, John. I'm in the most unenviable position you could possibly imagine as a speaker. I must follow a politician and a lawyer, which means I don't have any time left. Is Laurel Swanson here? Laurel? Okay. Is she? We like to make time at our conference to have greetings brought to us by various Lutheran church bodies, and you can't always get the head of those church bodies to come, but a representative. So introduce yourself and bring greetings to us, please.
Thank you, Dr. Lamb. I am Pastor Brad Miller. I am a pastor in the Lutheran Congregations and Mission for Christ. There is no head of the LCMC because of our fiercely congregational nature, but I've been a district president, and I've been at the establishment of a couple of our international districts. And so on completely unofficially, but completely heartfelt, accept, please, my greetings from many LCMC congregations. As part of our fierce congregational polity, we do not do social statements, but I think you would find a lot of commonality with many of our congregations, and that many of us share a deep compassion about matters of life. And that's why I am thrilled to be here today, even though my good friend Laurel, I know, is like-minded, and I don't know what has happened to keep her from getting all the way from Altoona, this great horrible distance across Des Moines. But it is a pleasure to be with you. God bless your continuing efforts, and it is wonderful that we share together so much of Luther's teaching, but we also share together such a passion for caring for the least of these around us.
Thank you, Pastor. Thank you very much, and I can affirm the great relationship that that Lutherans for Life has with the LCMC. I've been greeting at your gatherings. Well, you're about 10 or 11 years old now, since the very beginning. Now you're getting bigger, so they don't always have room for me, but used to be able to extend greetings, and they always welcome this Missouri Synod, so we appreciate that. Well, we don't have much time. We need to dismiss here very, very quickly for our pre-convention, pre-conference workshops, and I will do that in a second. I do want to get in my 2 cents worth, though, following the politician and the lawyer. And I just want to be able to just kind of build on what Colonel Eidsmo said about, he talked about John the Baptist in the womb, and life beginning at conception, and that's a embryological and biological fact, and Scripture affirms that fact. And I think we can, as Lutheran Christians, as pastors, we can. Governor quoted his football coach. I can quote my son's football coach, who always used to say, "Boys, we got to crank it up a notch, crank it up a notch." And here's the notch that we can crank it up. Here's a statement that I think it certainly doesn't disagree with anything you've heard here at all. I think it complements it. We are not for life just because we live in a society that isn't, but because we serve a God who is. That's where we come from with our theology. And so for us, we can look at this baby in the womb and not only say this is a human being, and not only say this is a person, but we can say this is a person created by the hands of God, knit together in its mother's womb. This is a person for whom Jesus Christ shed his blood on the cross. And this is a person that God desires to call into an eternal relationship with him in the waters of holy baptism. And that's the foundation upon which we stand to then move out and bring influence, first of all, to our fellow Christians, to our fellow Lutherans in our congregations, to help them understand that these are spiritual issues and that the gospel of Jesus Christ speaks so powerfully to them. And then properly motivated, you see, not motivated by anger or frustration, but motivated by this powerful message of the gospel, then we influence our one another and we bring our influence to bear then on our culture. So I'll close with my favorite thing to say. Many of you have heard me say it, but since it's my favorite thing to say, I like to say it a lot. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the most powerful and positive for life message in the universe. And it is tailor-made for these issues of life and death and pain and suffering and grief and regret and guilt. And pastors, we've been entrusted with that positive and powerful message. And we are called to articulate it, to share it with our people, and to take aim with it to the issues of the heart with which they are dealing. So I again thank you for doing that so faithfully. I encourage you to continue to do that in your ministries. Okay, Tricia, do you want to speak? You're standing up. Yeah, it's always hard to tell if Tricia's standing, but...
It would be very helpful if you would bus your own tables and get rid of the dirty dishes, because our next workshop, the Life Team Seminar, is happening in this room. So as you exit, if you would throw out those dirty dishes, thank you very much.
You are dismissed to your pre-conference workshops.